WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The mid-20th century witnessed the dawn of a new kind of building. These structures were characterized by simple, clean lines, large, bright windows, and open floor plans. Many were designed to fit in with nature and, in fact, to bring the outside in. Frank Lloyd Wright was one of the architects working in this new movement. Second only to Wright was Austrian-born architect Richard Neutra. His son, Dion, began working with his father as a child, later becoming an architect as an adult and eventually becoming president of the company his father founded. Today, he devotes a considerable amount of his time and talent to preserving the work of his father, which has fallen into that awkward stage that many structures go through. Too old to be modern, too young to be considered worth conserving. He believes they are worthy of saving and has been advocating strongly for their place in architectural history. That advocacy extends to this program today. Dion Neutra will be coming to Charlotte this week to speak about this at the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. He joins us in advance from the studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Company in Toronto. However, he's not in the studio yet. He joins us by phone for the moment here. Dion Neutra, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Sorry we're sitting out in the lobby instead of in the studio.
That's okay. We'll make do. And I guess maybe if they work you back into the studio, we'll get you on the air that way before the program is over. And with us also by phone, is George Smart, Executive Director of Triangle Modern Houses, a Raleigh-based advocacy group for modernist architecture. Mr. Smart, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Mike.
Dion, your father and Frank Lloyd Wright were the two most important architects of the modernist movement. Did they arrive at this style on their own, or did one influence the other? How did that work?
Well, people like to say that my father was influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright, but I don't really think that's true. I think that he got his inspiration from other sources, and his work was much more defined by openness to the outside, whereas Frank Lloyd Wright's work, if you look closely, mostly rather monumental, heavy structures with relatively small openings to the outside.
Yes, your father was known for bringing the outside in, which I want to talk about as we go through the program.
Right.
Richard Neutra was born in Austria-Hungary. He became a naturalized U.S. citizen in 1929 after working in Palestine and in Europe. And he did, in fact, work for a while with Frank Lloyd Wright. Was that because there was this mutual admiration, or it just happened to be that he ended up working with him?
Well, it's interesting. My father had admired Wright for many years, having seen the Wasmuth publication of 1908, and from that time on had an inspiration for him. But then what happened was he emigrated to the United States and met Frank Lloyd Wright in Chicago at the funeral of Louis Sullivan, an early modernist architect. They spoke together, and Wright offered Neutra an opportunity to work with him, which they accepted. And in early 1925, they spent about 2-3 weeks in Taliesin East. Wright was on the way to Tokyo because of the hotel, left Neutra in charge of one or two projects that he was working on, neither one of which materialized. So there was no more work in the studio, so the Neutras regretfully said goodbye and carried on towards Los Angeles, arriving there in the early part of 1925.
Now, I gave a short description of what this architecture looks like. So, George Smart, for the benefit of listeners who may not be certain exactly what we're talking about, I'd like to hear your take on what modernist architecture looks like.
Well, modernist architecture, for those that are uninitiated, is probably that strange house down the street you've always wondered about. That's a good starting point. Because modernist houses are really quite rare. The Triangle area in North Carolina has the third largest concentration of them after Los Angeles and Chicago. And still up here, they're only 0.25% of the housing stock. So there are really very few of them. But the people that buy them and own them and live in them a long time are pretty crazy about them.
And why? Why are they crazy about them?
It's because the modernist house is distinguishably different from a traditional construction. It has a totally different vibe. And that vibe, when you experience it, is something that has an effect on those that are living there. It tends to produce a more open feeling, a more relaxed feeling. And this is brought about by several structural functions. First of all, combining several common areas, like the living room or the dining room, for example, open plans with vaulted ceilings, large and very numerous windows, in many cases, floor-to-ceiling windows, flat or low-pitched roofs, long exposed beams, and extensive use of glass to bring in the natural light. And from the outside, what strikes most people are unusual geometric forms. It's not just a square box with seven windows across the front. It looks like something that someone actually spent some time creating.
Mm-hmm.
And you always know when you see a modernist house, although you might not know who's in it, but you see one and it excites a lot of people.
You know, some of the things, some of the interior design elements that you're talking about, the openness of the interior where the living room and the dining room are the same, and sometimes the living room, dining room, kitchen is one big unit, sound fairly contemporary. Even today, they sound fairly contemporary, but particularly so in a part of the country where most of the housing stock are these colonials or even some Cape yeah. Cods and split levels and things like that. How did this happen, Dion Neutcher, in the 1920s? This must have been considered really far out back then. Are you there, Mr. Neutcher?
Well, yeah, I'm here. my father had the opportunity in 1929 to complete the first major project, residential project that he worked on in Los Angeles, called the Lovell Health House. The reason he called it the Health House was the owner at that time came to him and said, I want to design a house that enhances the health of the user or the inhabitant. Hmm. What could we do to do that? And that, of course, was an extremely stimulating program for any architect to hear. My dad responded by providing sleeping balconies on the outside of the building where people could lounge in the nude, exercise facilities. We had a basketball court and some gymnastic type of equipment built in down below. And they had a special juice bar in the kitchen where you could do natural juices and things like that. So that was his response to the program. And in addition to that, the site was extremely difficult. So he came up with a modular steel, light steel construction, which was unheard of for a house residence in those days. So the combination of those things created a big stir, and thousands of people came to the opening of the house, and he thought his career was launched. Unfortunately, it was in the middle of the Depression, and he received not one new commission as a result of that. So instead, he started out on a world tour. He had received a lot of invitations to speak, and so he goes and took a world tour instead. Meanwhile, my mother took myself and my older brother to Switzerland for 8 months, and we visited with her parents. So that was how his career got started. Yeah. But it was a very slow start because as I say, there was a depression going on at the time.
But between 1920... Go ahead.
This is 1930, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What I think was one of the inspirations to his work was an industrial plant built in Rotterdam in the late 20s. And he saw pictures of that and made a point of visiting it on his tour. And through that connection, it became was born what became known as the international style. He didn't like the term very much. He didn't like to be identified with any kind of style at all. But that name came, you know, kind of stuck. And from then on out, that was what our work was called, international style.
But between 1929 and 1927 and 1969, your father, even though even though your father got off to a slow start in the Depression, between 1927 and 1969, he designed homes that became symbolic with the golden age of Hollywood. What was it about his designs and that part of the country and the people who wanted those homes? How did that confluence of things come together? Why Hollywood? Why those houses at that time?
It's a really good question. I think people responded to the, like George was saying, the openness, the lack of formality, the inventiveness of it. People would experience these and tell their friends, and people would come to us. We had a big group of Hollywood types who came, including Joseph von Sternberg, for example, the director who brought Marlene Dietrich to Hollywood, commissioned one of the most important houses called the von Sternberg House in San Fernando Valley, which unfortunately was torn down in 1972. But before that, Ayn Rand lived there, and we have photographs of her and my father sitting in the balcony. In fact, it's included in my new book, The Neutras, Then and Later, which I'm introducing this very week in Charlotte. It's the first publication of a series of case studies of our work where I look at our houses the way they were originally and then later, von Sternberg being one of them, and other houses and other structures that we designed are featured in this book. So it's a really wonderful opportunity to get familiar with this. This will be available on Amazon next month, The Neutras Then and Later.
You said if you had to sum up in one sentence these designs, these structures, you would say that we place man in relationship to nature. Have about a minute and a half left in this segment, so tell me how these buildings accomplish that.
Yeah, I think the way they accomplish it is by this use of trying to dissolve the structure as much as possible, having the thinnest possible columns in between the glass, and even painting those columns in aluminum color, which would reflect the light. Those were all features attempting to erase the borderline between inside and out. And everything we did about the design also tried in that direction. So it was a kind of a basic thing. Man came from nature originally a million years ago, and we haven't really made a good adjustment to being in a box with little windows yet. So people instinctively feel much more comfortable when they're in an interior where they can communicate with nature on the outside.
Given what he just said, George Smart, why don't we all live in houses like this? Because when you look at photographs of these houses from the inside, you really feel like, for instance, if you're in the living room, the sofa is sitting in the middle of the forest. That's what it feels like.
Yes.
So why don't more of us, and we have 20 seconds, why don't more of us live like that?
I think it boils down to that many people just don't want to live in a house that looks different from their neighbors.
We have to stop. I'll come back and get some more from you in just a moment about that. We're talking to Dion Neutra and George Smart about modernist architecture. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. The symphony and oratorio singers perform Mozart's Mass in C minor under the direction of Christopher Warren Green. Friday and Saturday, Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-972-2000. You know, we've talked about dogs on this program before, but as pets. And now we're going to look at a different world, the world of show dogs and dog shows. Perhaps you've seen them on TV and wondered what it takes to be a show dog. What are the judges looking for as these dogs prance around in a circle, as their owners follow them along? We're going to find out what makes a champion show dog, why pure breeds are so important, and meet a few of the competitors who I think will not have much to say, but we'll see tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, this Veterans Day, we look at how the nation is meeting the needs of today's vets, the challenges and opportunities facing those who've served in America's military.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about modernist architecture, particularly the architecture of Richard and Dion Neutra. Mr. Neutra, Dion Neutra, is coming to Charlotte on Thursday at 7 to speak at the Beckler Museum of Modern Art about this, and he has a new book about the houses he and his father designed, The Neutras, Then and Later, which is available at most outlets. George Smart is also with us, Executive Director of Triangle Modern Houses, Modernist Houses up in Raleigh. Mr. Neutra and Mr. George Smart are both on the phone. Mr. Neutra was supposed to be in a studio at, this is a great story, I'm going to tell it. He was supposed to be in a studio at the Canadian Broadcasting Company. He is, in fact, in the lobby of the Canadian Broadcasting Company because it's Veterans Remembrance Day there. The guard in the lobby can't leave his post to take him upstairs to the studio, and the people manning the studios can't come downstairs to get him because they're short-staffed on the holiday. So we apologize all the way around. Going back to George Smart, going back to the question I asked just prior to the break, and that is these houses, when you see photographs of the interiors, you feel like you're in the out of doors, and of course you are protected from the elements by these vast sheets of glass, and it's a great feeling just to look at the pictures. You get a great feeling. And you said, I asked you why we don't live in houses like this, more of us don't, and you said because we don't want our houses to look different from our neighbors, but
that's right.
But you that's know, right. people, it's been 80 years.
People are very attuned towards social fitting in. We tend to want larger and larger houses these days. That's why there's been this explosion of McMansions.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the function of the inside, that hasn't advanced very much, and the outsides look quite traditional. But our organization runs tours in modernist houses, and once we get people inside these structures, then they understand how wonderful they are, and they start wanting to buy one for themselves.
Hmm. Now, we've done a program about local modernist architecture in Charlotte in the past, in which these homes and businesses, business structures, have fallen into a category that architecture from other periods has also been subjected to at one time or another in the past, a period in which they are not appreciated because what was considered modern is no longer so. And yet these structures aren't old enough, as I said in the beginning, to be considered historic and therefore not worth preserving. Much of architecture of previous styles has been lost as a result of similar thinking, and now these designs face the same fate. So how do you forestall, I'm not sure who to ask this question of, how do you forestall the wrecking ball or considerable redesign and convince people that these structures do speak to today's needs? I'll start with Dion Neutra.
Okay, I have a spread called The State of Preservation in the United States. So I write something about what some of the tools are that we have available in our country. This is volume one of a series. Probably about 8 such books are going to be needed to cover the 400 projects that we built in our practice, now going on to its 9th decade. So the next book will have another spread in it, what preservation is like in Canada, for example, or countries in Europe, like I just came back from Switzerland, where I have a very different, they have a very different approach to this. I was able to visit some ancestral houses in Zurich where my great-grandfather lived. That house is still standing in the Niederdorf portion of Zurich. And they just preserve these buildings because they understand that it's a connection to the past. Whether it's 100 years old, 50 years old, or 30 years old, these buildings have a part in our history and deserve to be preserved. We do not yet understand that fully in the United States. You put buildings on lists, and you have all kinds of bully pulpits talking about it, but at the bottom, the final analysis, the building gets torn down. We have an example in Phoenix, for example, a Frank Lloyd Wright house designed for his son happens to be straddling the property line on two lots. The developer wants to subdivide and get more money. City of Phoenix is sitting there beating its chest and being impotent to be able to stop it. One of my proposals is there are two things. One, we need a national policy for preservation. We don't have that in our country. Number two, we need to have a super fund for preservation equal in size to the one we have for toxic waste sites, $15 billion. If you had that money in a pot, you could go in and buy this person out in a minute and figure out later how to repay the pot.
So these are that would be
we
not
don't have that tool.
That would be not unlike land trusts that have begun to proliferate around the country to preserve undeveloped land. Where would this money come from?
Well, we'd have to make a commitment to it. It's like, where does the money come from? The toxic waste to people. I don't know where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's some kind of a tax. Maybe there's some kind of whatever. But it first has to start with a policy. We do think it's important to save these things. We will not stand by and watch them be torn down. We will rescue them when needed and come up with the public money to do it. That's very different than it is in other countries.
Dion, you may not know this, but the David Wright House was sold last week to a private owner. It has been saved.
It has been saved. I'm so thrilled.
Now, fill us in.
That's only because a private owner stepped up to the plate.
That's right.
Fill us in, George Smart. What is the David Wright House?
The David Wright House was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright for one of his sons. It's a house in Phoenix.
Oh, that's the house he's talking about.
Yes, and an offer was made on it last week, primarily brought about through all the publicity across the country. These houses need a lot of attention, and they need a wide net of publicity to attract the right owner. Dion was involved very much so in a house in Beverly Hills a few months back that was in danger of being torn down. And that eventually attracted an owner who's going to be coming in and going to restore it. So Dion has been very central in a lot of these cases with his own and his father's work, and also part of a larger national scene where through the internet the information is much more available to help people find these houses. That wasn't certainly true 10 or 20 years ago, where word about them was very difficult to spread.
When we talked about modernist architecture and the need to save it, to preserve it, I think it was several years ago on this program, and we were talking about it locally here in the Charlotte area. It was said by someone on the program that people seem to have an inability to appreciate the significance in structures that they watched being built.
Yeah.
Well, some of these houses are old enough now that we didn't see them being built. They've been around since we're cognizant. Is this a U.S. phenomenon, or is this something that is shared by people around the world? That if we saw it go up, it has no value.
In the U.S., we tend to negate a lot of these houses in recent memory, and one big reason is they don't evoke the past in us. If we look at a colonial Williamsburg revival, it sort of looks old. But when we look at a number of these Neutra houses and certainly modernist houses in general, they were all very future-oriented, very progressive. So while some of them may not be in the best shape now or a little dated, they don't really look old. And it's difficult for people to get their heads around, how can I be preserving a building that doesn't look like it's 100 years old?
For those who are still uncertain about exactly the style of house we're talking about, we have several photographs of these houses on our website at WFAE.org if you'd like to take a look at them. You mentioned earlier in the program, George, that North Carolina has the third largest concentration of modern houses in America, more than anywhere else except Los Angeles and Chicago. And I'm just curious as to how that happened in Stade, Raleigh, North Carolina, and Chapel Hill in Durham. How did it happen?
It happened when NC State decided to recruit a new dean for their School of Design in 1948. Henry Camp Hefner came from Oklahoma. He recruited the faculty and many of the students who started the first year. And over the next 5 years, North Carolina State University became a powerhouse in architectural education. He also encouraged the faculty as well as the students to take commissions on the side, to build houses and other buildings for their friends and family themselves. And so all around this area, Greensboro and Charlotte, sprung up these incredible houses, which over the decades sort of fell off the map. And we have assembled all these on a website called Triangle Modernist Houses, where people can see the houses and where they are and some of their history. And we also have one of the most comprehensive collections of all of Richard Neutra's works.
In Raleigh? In the Triangle area?
He doesn't have any works in North Carolina, but okay. We have his national collection.
I see. You're third in the country, and I think Charlotte is number two in the state in terms of modernist architecture being available.
Yes.
How did that happen here, do you know?
Well, in Charlotte, there were a lot of great architects, but there was one in particular, A.G. Odell, who came to fame from designing the original Charlotte Coliseum.
Which is still standing.
It was, at the time, the largest unsupported structure in the world. It was this giant dome, and it was just amazing. It was published everywhere. And from that commission, he got many, many other commissions around the state and the southeast, designing office buildings primarily, but he also did some really cool houses for friends and clients in the Charlotte area, about a dozen of them.
And I'm curious as to how that happened. I mean, were there just a few very forward-thinking people who wanted their house to stand out? Because you said a little while ago that we all want to fit in to the neighborhood. And who were these people that wanted their homes to stand out, and how did the people around them, both here in Charlotte and in the Triangle area, feel about these strange-looking houses going up in their very staid neighborhoods?
Well, there were a number of very progressive people. They tend to be more in the arts or design. But a large chunk of them in North Carolina were Jewish merchants who, by statute, were prohibited from living in certain areas of town. So they would hire architects to design them these wonderful, elaborate modernist houses just outside the city limits or in places where the zoning was not discriminatory towards Jews at the time. And many of these are still around. This was true across North Carolina. It was true in small towns like Jacksonville and Goldsboro, as well as Charlotte.
I think we just lost Dion Neutra. He talked a little bit a while ago, Mr. Smart, about the need to have some sort of a preservation trust developed in this country so that monies could be put toward buying and preserving properties that were targeted for demolition. Historic preservationists have a number of tools in their toolkit that seem to help them in their preservation efforts. And I'd like to hear what tools are effective in the preservation of modernist structures. Are they the same tools that people use to preserve structures that were built in the 1700s and 1800s, or is it a different set of tools?
Well, for us, it's a different set. I see preservation a little bit differently than Dion. I would love for there to be a fund set aside for what he described. But until that happens, it's really a marketing problem. We have to get people aware of these houses and coveting these houses so that when they do come on the market, which all of them eventually will, there's somebody standing by waiting to buy it, someone who has fallen in love with that house and just can't wait to write a check.
Now, you are not an architect.
No.
Your father, I believe, was an architect. But you had no interest in architecture until 2007 when you stumbled upon something on Google. What was that?
I was searching for modernist houses. I was thinking of building one, which I have since, and came across these names, George Matsumoto, Henry Kamphefner, Jim Fitzgibbon, Brian Shawcroft, that just were incredibly familiar. And it took me a while to figure out that my dad had taken me around to see these gentlemen, these architects, and some of their houses when I was 8 or 9 years old. So it was like that scene in Alien where the little creature bursts from the guy's stomach. All of a sudden, architecture burst from my DNA, and I was hooked.
Then from the point of view of someone who came to this late and has in sense built himself a house that's modernist in architecture, explain to people what it feels like in terms of living there now, in terms of what you lived in before.
One of the things that modernist architecture forces you to do is to get rid of some of your clutter. If you look at most pictures in magazines and modernist houses, you don't see a lot of stuff. Whereas in most of our houses, and in my old house included, you walk in, it looks like a Cracker Barrel exploded. I mean, there's just stuff everywhere.
Well, how do you do that? That's another
modernist architecture forces you to throw away some things, to focus more on the space itself, and that in turn pays off by just making the house incredibly attractive to live in, to entertain in, to relax in. It's something where when you come home, you really are enjoying being home.
But how do you get, because we all get mail and we all get stuff. Things come into our lives, some of which we buy, some of which we don't. And it's a full-time job prioritizing and going through stuff and throwing it away. If you're a cluttered person and you decide to buy one of these houses and you know you have to become decluttered, how do you do it? It's a retraining. You have to retrain yourself, don't you?
Either that or a very large storage unit.
The other thing that strikes me about these houses is that because they are open to the outside and because they have they're all designed with very neat, clean lines. And the furniture that you usually find in these houses also is designed with neat, clean lines that sometimes it can appear to – and because they're so neat and uncluttered, it can appear to the uninitiated – that it's a cold environment. It's not warm and cozy.
Exactly. And one of the criticisms of modernist architecture for years has been that austerity that turns people off. So over the last 20 or so years, you've seen a more warm modern come about. You've seen an emergence of different textures and different materials on the inside, even concrete, which we think of as a very cold material, when it's used inside a house for flooring, for instance, warms it up quite a bit. I've seen houses that have concrete walls or even a concrete kitchen countertop that are very attractive and evoke the same kind of warmth that a hardwood or granite countertop would do in a traditional house. So the use of creative materials makes a big difference in that warmth.
That's George Smart, who's executive director of Triangle Modernist Houses. We're talking about modernist architecture in advance of Dion Neutscher's arrival in Charlotte at the Beckman Museum of Modern Art on Thursday. He's part of the program as well, although we have temporarily lost our phone connection to him, and we're working on getting him back. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Creative Loafing, where readers can find offers every day on entertainment, food, and more at cltdeals.com. Diane Rehm and her guest coming up at 10 o'clock discussing how our nation is meeting the needs of today's veterans and their families. On this Veterans Day celebration, the challenges and opportunities facing those who have served in America's military in 20 minutes at 10 on WFAE's Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
WFAE kicks off the holiday season with the Charlotte Symphony. We'll be at the Symphony's Magic of Christmas concert on Friday evening, November 30th at Blumenthal's Belk Theater. After the concert, we're hosting a dessert reception with the opportunity to meet some of the musicians and other special guests. Ticket and reception information is available at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Dion Neutra and his father, Richard Neutra, and their style of architecture that is synonymous with the Golden Age of Hollywood. He has written a new book called Neutra Architecture, The View from Inside. Well, excuse me, that's the name of his talk, but he's written a new book called The Neutras Then and Later, which takes a look at some of the structures that the Neutras built over the years, at how they originally appeared and the conditions they find themselves in today, with an eye toward encouraging more preservation of these structures, these modernist structures that are not unlike the work of Frank Lloyd Wright. George Smart joins us by phone from Raleigh. He's executive director of Triangle Modernist Houses, and you can find their website, I believe, at give me the website again, George.
TriangleModernistHouses.com.
And Dion Neutra is with us, or will be with us again, we hope. We lost our phone connection. It's been a comedy of errors up in Canada today, but that's okay. We'll deal with the hand we were we'll play the hand we were dealt here this afternoon or this morning. Toby on Facebook has a question for you. He writes, how do you see Charlotte's future in regards to modern residential architecture? Is there a change in appreciation and desire for a more modern lifestyle?
I think so. Historic Charlotte has put on twice now a modernist house tour. They do it every 2 years. The next one will be in May of 2013. And they're one of the leading towns in the state to invest in this area and subsequently have attracted more attention to the houses in need of saving. There was one in particular, the Laster House, which was designed by A.G. O'Dell, that was very close to being bulldozed. It was purchased and I think has been completely renovated now. And I'm hoping that it will be on the tour in 2013.
We have gotten Dion Neutra back with us by phone, and I'm glad we could do that. Mr. Neutra, you said that you have lived to see a substantial portion of the hundreds of work that you built, either destroyed completely, remodeled so extensively as to lose much of their semblance to the original quality, or subjected to, and I quote here, the ego trip of architects who claim to be able to divine what the Neutras would have done to resolve whatever new owners needed to accommodate their needs. I'm just curious, if you buy a structure like this, or if you own a house like this, why would you want to alter or destroy its essential character by remodeling it or converting it into something else, especially given its pedigree, if it's a real Neutra home?
Well, that's been my question to these people, but it turns out that a lot of people would rather have their own interpretation of what it is we would have liked to do rather than go back to the source. Obviously, that provides much more freedom to do what you want to do. So far, at least at this time, people are not recognizing that they actually own what I would call a piece of art. If you buy a Picasso, you're not likely to be remodeling the colors because it doesn't fit your color scheme. Because when you do that, you lose the value of the mm-hmm. painting. So that's where we have to get to. We have to get to that degree of understanding to realize that you're messing, you know, with Mother Nature here when you start having your own way with these houses.
Yeah, the designs that we're talking about, your father's designs, your designs, those of Frank Lloyd Wright, these people were artists. And they, as you say, they designed these works of art. These are not ordinary houses that are put up by developers, all painted beige and framed. These are specially designed homes. And to alter them would be like painting a mustache on the Mona Lisa, it seems to me.
Exactly right. So that's why this program is so valuable, Mike. I mean, people need to hear this coming from the horse's mouth and start to develop an understanding that, yes, indeed, they have a piece of art in their hands and they should not mess with it. I mean, I don't know what to say. I have people who call and say they want to work with me to restore these houses, but so often they have a friend in town, a local person, who says, you don't need Neutra. I went to school. I studied Neutra. Mm. So I understand pretty well what they would do. So why don't you let me do it with you?
Let's talk about that for a second. Your father was famous for the attention he gave to defining the real needs of his clients, in contrast to other architects who were eager to impose their own artistic vision on a client. Your father used to do surveys of what they wanted, what they liked, what they needed, what they hoped the house would be, and then he would design the house given that information.
Right.
And I know that you would like to be involved with architects working to update or change Neutra design homes for their
right.
clients.
Yeah.
Is that because in doing so, you could, in fact, meet those owners' 21st century needs in a way that would maintain the integrity of the original design in the same way that your father might have done it? Because he would have sat down and said, okay, let's talk about what you want.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, there's so many, many small decisions that need to be made every time you start an intervention. For example, you're going to restore some finish or something that has worn out. But today there's no equivalent for that available anymore. A typical solution is to put a granite countertop in instead of the formica that we had. But I just visited a house that we designed in Ticino, the Italian part of Switzerland, which was restored recently to the tune of 5 million Swiss francs. And the person who worked on it, an architect, local architect, took me through and showed me. Now, in this case, they didn't consult our office, but we lucked out. This man really had an understanding of what the problem was. So when it came to changing the formica countertops, he did not put the granite in. He actually researched and found a modern equivalent to formica and restored that countertop using that material. Now, that's the kind of decision that tries to preserve the historical fabric of the house, even though you do have to occasionally find new materials. And it's all a matter of how you go back to the original, see how it was done, and then try to get to it as closely as possible.
Your father did some extensive work, actually, as a landscape architect prior to moving into home building and office, industrial buildings, I mean, business structures. And in fact, his first work in L.A. was as a landscape architect. And of course, one of the things he achieved with his architecture was bringing the outside in.
Right.
But when you bring the outside in, it seems to me you also bring the inside out, particularly at night. How do you prevent feeling like you're living in a fishbowl?
Well, I mean, I guess it's a sort of a choice. I mean, people who commission houses like this realize that there's going to be exposure to the outside. Some people use drapes if they feel exposed too much. But we, for example, in our situation, our house is broadly featured in this first volume of my book because it's a very unusual case. Both my father and myself lived there separately. Each of us did our own thing on that house, and it is broadly exposed. Just to give you a little history, during the time that the VDL house, the family house, was destroyed by fire and was being rebuilt, there was a two-year period where my parents didn't have a place to live, so they bought this house that had been designed a dozen years earlier and lived there for 2 years. During that time, my dad had drapes covering up the glass. to my knowledge, he never closed the drapes, but he did have the drapes. Later, when the house was when they moved back to the research house, they sold the same house to us, myself and my second wife, and her two children. We did extensive remodeling on the house, and then removed all the drapes. My wife was a little uncomfortable in the master bedroom. She thought that we should be able to drape those windows. But it turns out that after a while, she got used to it, and it was okay. We you really can't look in from the outside anyway, and there's a lot of greenery out there. So people get used to it, and they say, well, it's okay. We can live with that. So I think it's a matter of getting used to it.
You and your father also worked on a number of commercial buildings. Do those buildings share the same philosophy of design that the homes do?
Yeah, they do. I mean, our first thought is to enhance the productivity of the user and the well-being of the user. So, of course, we're going to try to expose them to the outside as much as possible, especially if there's something to see out there. So, yes, we tend to approach it from that direction.
You've been working to save a number of those structures that your father designed, from private homes to the 1962 Gettysburg Battlefield Cyclorama, which I visited as a child, and at the American Embassy in Karachi, Pakistan.
Right.
How difficult an effort is preserving these buildings, like the Gettysburg Cyclorama and the embassy?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Cyclorama. It turns out that after visiting with you in Charlotte, one of our stops is going to be Atlanta, and that happens to be on the very day that we celebrate the 149th anniversary of the most famous speech given in the history of our country. Do you happen to know what that is?
The Gettysburg Address.
There we go. Do people know what the date is? No.
No.
Nobody knows that date. Our building was designed specifically to commemorate that event. We're only 200 feet away from where Lincoln stood when he gave that speech. I've been trying for the last dozen years to get the Park Service to realize that this was a perfect site for what I would call the Abraham Lincoln Museum at Gettysburg. They have since moved the cyclorama painting from our building out to another site, leaving our building empty, and they claim it's obsolescent and should be torn down. I say that we could recreate the events leading up to the Gettysburg Address in that theater. We could recreate the three-day battle that happened on that site in a most dramatic possible form, as opposed to the static cyclorama painting, which you can also see in another location. So what could be a better use of a taxpayer-funded facility than to repurpose it to find a new use?
I got to tell you, I went there as a child. I haven't been back since. But there are two things I remember about my visit to Gettysburg. It is that building and what took place in it, and being in a formation of rocks that our teacher told us was where one side or the other hid and fired from. Those are the two things that I remember from that experience. So,
and I'm sure that you used the restroom in our building as well, right?
I'm sure I did. Sure. Now, both of those buildings, the Cyclorama at Gettysburg and the American Embassy in Karachi, Pakistan, it would seem to me should have particular significance to the government, to the U.S. Park Service, and to the State Department, because in the case of Gettysburg, the building has architecturally historic significance while sitting on an historic site. And in Pakistan, the building, it seems to me, is representative not only of the United States as an embassy, but of a significant style of architecture that blossomed in the United States. Does the State Department see any value in that?
Yeah, you know, I cannot understand why this is like a $15 billion deal to buy this site in the city of Karachi. Why the State Department cannot see in their interest to make a donation of this site to the government of Pakistan. Think about a PR deal that could be, you know, headlines could be made. U.S. government makes a gift for a cultural center for the city of Pakistan. Wouldn't that be a nice thing to, in contrast to some of the strain that's been in between the relationships recently? I mean, I don't understand why this is such a difficult question. People in the city of Pakistan are putting up a big fight and trying to raise money to buy this thing. But, hey, how about some help here?
Your father also designed furniture, and recently a German furniture company expressed interest in reproducing some of those designs. And interestingly, their U.S. headquarters is here in Charlotte in the South End. Where does that effort stand?
Well, it's very interesting. They approached me, and I, of course, looked them up and checked them out and everything. They're primarily schoolhouse furniture people. But, of course, the Germans are well known for their craftsmanship and beauty of execution, so I immediately jumped on the idea. And so then, as a part of this whole negotiation, which has gone on the last few months, they heard about this fact that I was coming out with this book. So they said, is there any chance we could get a spread in on the furniture in the book? So we quickly shifted gears, and I managed to get in 6 pages, oh, I call it the Neutra Furniture Then and Later, in which we show all of the prototypes that we are going to be using for the Germans to produce. They were very generous and said, okay, if you can do that, we're going to buy 500 copies of your book, but it's going to have to be out in time for your lecture in Charlotte. So we sweated blood and tears to manage to make that happen, and I'm so proud to say that there are copies of the book waiting for me when I get to Charlotte. I'm going to speak tomorrow here in Toronto. We have a box of books here available. So we were able to actually get it produced in time to air freight these books at great expense to these locations.
And George Smart, although there are no Neutra homes here, among what your organization calls the top five endangered modernist houses in North Carolina is the Mark Bernstein House in Charlotte near Carmel Rhone. He was the architect. How does that house compare to those of Richard Neutra? Very quickly.
Well, definitely it's not up to the same gold standard as Neutra, but this is a fascinating house. It was designed for a family. It has these incredible children's rooms with little ladders and tunnels and nooks, which are just exhilarating if you're, you know, a small child. And it's been empty for quite a few years and really needs a new owner to take a look at it.
George Smart is Executive Director of Triangle Modernist Houses. Dion Neutra is coming to Charlotte on Thursday to speak at the Beckler Museum of Modern Art at 7 p.m. about the Neutra design oeuvre. Thank you both for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.